the world is hollow, and I have touched the sky. Somebody had to do that. It's one of these episodes that you're getting into serious retread territory, and then I read on Memory Alpha that one of the other side, maybe it wasn't that, but that if you look at the order they were all broadcast in, or produced in, actually, I think it was, is that this one was done awfully close to Spock's brain.
Oh, God.
But the weird thing is that it has some very, very similar plot ideas in it. And I'm already jumping ahead to a bunch of objections to it, but it's funny, I feel like we've talked about this one, but I don't think we actually recorded it, so.
I think we did talk about it a little bit.
Yeah, we did. I was just so I'll go ahead and start out. The this episode I know I disliked when I was younger. All the melodramatic McCoy with the terminal disease love interest business was pretty damn boring to young me. And so this is one I generally gave a pass to, like skipping it.
How does old...
Old man John is a little bit more sympathetic, at least the parts of it. The part of it that is probably the most interesting is the fact that that its center is often on McCoy, in a way that the show almost never does, and for that reason alone it has some interest, but unfortunately it has a lot of serious weaknesses, and I remember watching it and thinking, oh my God, the costumes are they're already getting ready for The Way to Eden, or some of these. Kind of hippie 60s looking colors and things like that the people on the asteroid wear. The whole thing seems very recycled. Outside of the McCoy romance death plot, it seems like an episode we've definitely seen before. And that's really unfortunate, because it's still a good idea. It just feels like they reused it too soon. It's not Spock's brain, it's Paradise Syndrome that was produced very close to this one. And that episode has a lot of big similarities with its story and ideas.
Is it possible that the... just because you were talking about it being recycled,
yeah.
Is it possible that the set for the Oracle was recycled from Paradise Syndrome, or... or another episode, or is it just seems similar to me?
I think reading on the little background notes, the only thing they did recycle some things, but it was more of the asteroid scenes. Since that episode has a lot of has that giant asteroid coming at the planet instead of the ship being an asteroid, so it's kind of a dumb distinction, but that's I don't think any of that was recycled, as far as I know. But overall, kind of a yawn, and again, nice to see McCoy getting something in the romance department, and although it leaves a lot of questions, and it feels very, very contrived with the "I've got 1 year to live, Jim," and all that stuff, that feels awfully forced and very convenient. But so I'll start with that and turn it over to one of you guys if you want to.
Be my guest, Rob.
Oh, no, Eric, it's your turn.
Rob?
So I felt similarly about this episode to John. I remember not liking it much. Although I think I did, even as a kid, find the McCoy angle of the episode was kind of poignant. I think and I do think that the best parts of the episode are when Kirk and Spock learn about his illness and when they try to deal with it, and I think especially Nimoy handles it pretty effectively in character Spock, and you can see that he's really troubled by it, but then you see the kind of resignation and the Vulcan part of him kind of taking over, and I think it's really effective. So those are some of the best parts of the episode, But the rest of it, the planet side aspects of it,
and yet another really, computer really definitely running, running the society,
right? Which is like we've seen that so many times before. And the other, I think a big weakness of this is that the writers to the extent and the producers to the extent that they really thought about it, felt like the McCoy twist would carry it, and that they could kind of, the rest of it could kind of just be same old, same old. But a lot of the development of, you know, kind of uncovering the mystery, sort of the act one sort of aspects of the episode are especially weak for that reason, because they, once we learn about McCoy's predicament, and yeah, we see him kind of falling in love with the priestess, I forget her name, I always...
Natira.
And you know, maybe, Rob, that's part of the problem with this one when you're rewatching it, is the fact that it relies on that, and once you've seen it, you know that, well, you know, nothing's going to come of it. So.
And if it had happened early on in the series, it may have been more interesting than it is at this point, but here it's just kind of... And they spend a lot of time, like, repeating, oh, these people live on a spaceship and they don't know it. Okay, yeah, whatever. So
exactly.
I think that's why a lot of it just falls flat to me. And I think the costumes are especially bad in this one, and I think we even when we watch it on our older TVs, it looked bad, and now it just looks like these horrible pajamas that the guards are wearing, like snorkeling masks on their heads, and it's really bad.
It's cheap and gaudy.
And the priestess, and gaudy, and feels very thrown together. And I think it's really interesting to compare this episode to the Tholian Web, which we don't have to talk about, because I watched both of them today.
Yeah.
The Tholian Web, it seems like, was an episode that an awful lot of resources were used to produce. There are a lot of optical effects in the Tholian Web, and a lot of parts of the ship, you know, are shown in that episode too. And so it's just interesting that this one felt like a really cheap episode, although maybe the Oracle set piece they did have to spend some money on.
Although in retrospect it probably costs more.
And I have to tell you guys, I've been reading this book called These Are the Voyages, and it's, I don't know if you've heard of it.
I've heard of it, I haven't read it.
Yeah, I've heard of it too.
It probably cost more. So, because it was free on Amazon Prime, I've been reading the book about the first season.
Uh-huh.
And it's incredibly interesting, incredibly revealing about the production of these episodes and how many of the mistakes that we identify were known about at the time, but were really just driven by just circumstances, you know, by budgets or by people, actors, you know, dropping out, like the actor who played Lazarus was a fill-in for the actor who dropped out the night before filming started. So all these things that you think, oh, this episode's really terrible, and a lot of times there are reasons for it. Legitimate reasons for it. Anyway.
Interesting. I'll have to check that out.
A lot about how much of it is cost.
That's great. This episode had a little bit of new sets and things like that they built. It's very possible it was more expensive than Day of the Dove, for example, which was almost all reusing existing sets, except maybe that one planet set at the beginning. But this one had some, but again, it was still pretty bad.
You know, one of the things that I think is interesting, just a little touch that I noted, is that the old man is the same actor who was in Return of the Archons, and he was also in The Cage. He was
the scientist guy.
Yeah, Dr. Theodore Haskins or something like that.
Yeah, three different episodes.
And the interesting thing is
right.
that the background music they're playing when they introduce his character in The Cage is the same music that they're playing when he comes in the room in this episode.
No shit.
Yeah.
Wow. I did not catch that. I wonder if there's anything to that.
I don't know, but I was just I actually rewatched it today, and I was going, wait a second, yeah, it's the same. It's that same kind of lilting flute piece.
Huh. Okay.
You know, as far as this episode goes, I'm sorry. As far as this episode goes, I pretty much agree with you guys about your takes on it. I've noticed that the Oracle very strongly resembles both Vol and Landru.
Oh shit, I forgot about Vol.
Yeah. And you know, the comparison you made with Spock's brain, actually, there are certain plot elements of Spock's brain, you know, the society living underground, ignorant of, well, a lot of things.
It's ruled by a woman.
Yeah. And,
okay. Stretch, but
I guess you could even draw some parallels between, this and A Taste of Armageddon, but A Taste of Armageddon was a far better episode.
Oh, yeah.
The one thing that I touched on earlier in one of our earlier casts is that, or maybe it was when we were just talking, but this is yet another episode that fairly blatantly plagiarizes a Robert Heinlein novel, this time one called Orphans of the Sky. And it is actually maybe my favorite Heinlein novel. It's actually a novelette. It's just about 100 pages. But it's about a giant, well, I guess you would call it a colonization ship that was launched from Earth, and I think in the 22nd century, and without giving away too much, due to a series of events and disasters, the crew is killed and the passengers degenerate into a society that doesn't understand that they're on a ship. And
yeah,
the whole story pretty much revolves around that. But it was on rewatching this episode that I don't know why it never occurred to me before, but it just jumped out at me that, you know, they, I mean, it wasn't exactly the same. I mean, this is an asteroid, or a ship that was designed to look like an asteroid. Well, it's still a ship. And the inhabitants don't know that they're on a ship, and it's not exactly out of control, but the people or mechanisms that control it are no longer functioning the way they should, so.
A lot of similarities.
Yeah.
Yeah, figures.
So this is, you'll find this interesting, Eric, when you read that book. There were actually a lot of script treatments that were solicited early on in the series from famous science fiction writers.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them did not, they just wouldn't work because they,
right,
science fiction writers didn't know how to write for television, or they would write a treatment that would require too many special effects to actually, you know, execute. But another thing that actually happened more than once that is interesting is that one of the regular writers, you know, someone like Gene Kuhn, would come up with a that would be very similar to a science fiction story that he had read. You know, he'd kind of read a lot of science fiction over the years, Gene Kuhn especially, and he would come up with a story treatment under stress, you know, he's trying to come up with ideas. And more than once it happened that he came up with something that was already, that he'd just forgotten, you know,
yeah,
that he'd read it somewhere, and a couple of times it had to actually compensate the authors.
Yeah.
So.
Rob, you keep dropping out.
Yeah. Dropped out entirely.
Rob?
Because the development of these scripts was a lot more complicated than for most of the episodes than at first I thought. You know, a lot of times there was someone else involved that's not credited at all, or it would start with a story treatment that would go through all sorts of, you know, different manifestations before we finally make it onto the air. So anyway, I think that's really fascinating that that was a Heinlein story, that the sort of concept.
Right. Actually, there's another book called Inside Star Trek, and I'm kind of reading that in downtimes between other books. But it sounds like it covers a lot of the same ground as the book that you're talking about. One thing about Roddenberry is that he was very well read in science fiction. He was a hardcore science fiction fan. And two of his favorite authors were Robert Heinlein and Isaac Asimov. And Asimov actually, he consulted him in the production of the original series. And actually, Asimov was a consultant on motion picture as well. And I think what you alluded to happened because he was approached. Asimov was approached to write some scripts for the original series, but nothing that he could come up with would fit the series format and would be producible, so on and so forth. But with regards to Heinlein, there is another Heinlein book called Space Cadet, which lays out an organization, a space fleet, very much like Starfleet, and an academy, much like Starfleet Academy. And that was really, it was called the Patrol rather than Starfleet in Heinlein's book, but that was actually the basis, the genesis of Starfleet.
Huh, interesting.
So, I don't know if Heinlein was one of them who had to be compensated, but, you know, this episode and even more so Operation Annihilate both very, very heavily drew on Heinlein's work. So, anyway, that was my two cents.
What did you guys think of the acting in this one?
I thought Kelly was good. I don't know.
The woman playing Datira was a little bit too. I don't want to say over the top because it wasn't like scenery chewing, but it was this. The way she read her dialogue was almost like, I am mysterious. I'm from different people. You know, it was like this. This weird mannerism she had.
Yeah.
It could have been the direction, or you know, who knows? But
she had a funky accent. Yeah.
It did, like, that had to be a little exotic to go with her weird costume and funky hair.
Yeah, kind of like what Marina Sirtis did in Next Gen.
Oh, okay. You know, I'm going to stop you right there because that's something I've been thinking about. It because I've been rewatching some Next Gen stuff lately.
Uh huh.
Because I've got a hold of some of the Blu-ray versions that are done, redone in HD, which are really amazing, which we can talk more about later at another time. But the one thing I don't understand about her is why they felt the need to have her do any accent. Why didn't she just talk like she normally does? She's English.
Yeah.
Because I just wonder if, you know, if her because a lot, oftentimes her line reading is a little awkward in that show, and I wonder if part of if she was not asked to do an American or some other kind of non-English sounding accent, if she would have come off better.
Well, you know, my understanding is that she was asked to come up with some kind of accent to help set her apart from the other crew members, or to give some kind of indication that she was
not a human.
Yeah, she was only half human.
See, I don't, I get that, but it's really, and maybe it's just a limitation of the actor or something like that, but I just wonder if she would have been more effective if she had not done that.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. It just occurred to me. It's like, because when you see her in interviews and other off stage kind of things, she sounds a lot better.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and then you see her delivering dialogue in the show, and it's sometimes awkward.
Yeah.
But, yeah, just a little sidetrack there. I just,
so have you been...
It's the same thing as this episode, where she's being directed again, probably, to deliver... Like, you are not just a normal person. You're the high priestess of this alien civilization living on an asteroid.
Right.
And so, talk different.
Did, just out of curiosity, have you been watching first season Next Gen?
No, I grabbed third season, so those are the ones I've mostly looked at.
Oh, okay. Because, yeah. I mean, her... the character of Deanna Troi changed significantly over the course of the series.
Mm-hmm. No doubt. No, she improved a lot. But yeah. Just in general, though, I just wonder, because if she sounded English, that would have been enough, although maybe because Patrick Stewart keeps his English accent, that you can't have two English-sounding people. there can only be one. But throughout the history of movies... You know, foreign people are often English accented.
Yeah.
Anything from Arabs to Roman Empire people or other types, the English heavy actors get to play them.
Yeah.
Keep their accents. You know, they don't make them sound weird and different just because
right.
They're not Americans. So it just got me thinking.
So I have to mention this tidbit right here because it's so relevant to what we're talking about, which is there's a character, John, that you've talked about before from Return of the Archons. And I think that his name, he's the one, this kind of unforgettable character. You know what I'm talking about?
Weird guy.
Oh,
the festival and...
Yes.
It was...
Yeah, who's cut from a...
And I forget which
wrecked play or something like that. Or...
Yeah, I know who you're talking about, Rob. I wish I could remember. Hold on a second.
We'll go to your house. Something like that. Somebody's looking it up. Accessing.
So.
Anyway, so. I keep getting cut off, guys, so that's why if you're hearing silence from me, that's
yeah, fine. And the recording.
So the actor who played Beelhar, it was revealed in this book I'm reading. He thought he misunderstood his direction, and he thought that everyone was going to have they were all going to have New England accents, and so that's why he sounds strange. That's why because he's trying to do a New England accent.
Wow.
But nobody else got the memo, or everyone else sort of. So that was the reason for that.
I love it.
Is that weird? So he's kind of like trying doing like a festival. I
Okay, that certainly makes some sense. Yeah. Although I love the quirkiness of his acting.
Oh, he's so striking.
Yeah.
And then he has that outfit too with the bowler hat, especially.
And the facial expressions. He's just weird.
Oh, just as a point of interest, the guy who played the old man and played Tamar in Return of the Archons and Theodore Haskins in The Cage, his name, John Lormer, died in 1986. I'm still trying to find the name of
Andrew. Yeah, I missed the first season. The Wastelands. Well,
Beelar.
Beelar, yes.
Yeah, and his name, Ralph Marer.
Okay.
Yeah, Beelar with the ridiculous bowler hat. Although he was also one of the SS guards in Patterns of Force.
No shit, he was, huh?
Yeah. I never would have recognized him.
Yeah.
Maybe he didn't have any dialogue.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, just to wrap up the Next Gen business, because, you know, it's just a tangent, but these are the from the Blu-ray versions that are out now, that they're not done with them yet, actually. I think season 5 is the most recent that they've done, but these are have been rescanned into high definition from the original film.
Hmm.
And they even rescanned all the effects shots and models and everything else, so they look really good. But the thing that's great about them is that the effects shots are not redone like they are in the original series high def versions.
Hmm.
So you really do see the effects. They're slightly, I think they had to do a little bit of fiddling with them to make them work, but really, they look like the old effects from the old shows, but they're just better.
And, cool.
The first one I watched, that very first episode of season 3, which is the one I got a hold of, they close up on Will Wheaton, and he obviously had acne on his face at the time, and you can totally see how they covered it up with makeup and things like that. But you can in the HD version, you can see it.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, that wasn't meant to be seen at all.
Yeah.
And so once in a while you see something like that, and the makeup looks a lot more garish on the women especially, which stands out more when you have higher resolution. But overall it looks great, and very, very fun to see them.
How do the sets look?
You know, they're not bad.
Yeah. Once in a while, they would look better.
You see something that looks a little bit cheap looking, but really they're pretty good. Yeah, not bad at all. Not bad. So highly recommended if you get a chance to see them.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're nice, and it seems like they're really doing it right. You know, just keeping it looking like it's supposed to, but updated.
Right.
And it sounds like it's a lot of work for them to do, which is why it's been taking them years, literally, to get them all done.
So, are they cool. planning to do the same thing for Deep Space Nine? And
I haven't heard if they're going to do DS9 yet or not. One of the things that I think partway through DS9 they started doing the effects using CG.
Oh, okay.
Whereas all of Next Gen was done with models and opticals and all that stuff.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah. Almost all of it was.
I would swear that it was, they were computer effects.
No.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, they still use models, but they did them on video, which is why they always, you know, why they look crummy now. But they went back to the original, so they would shoot the Enterprise model and planets and stuff with cameras, real 35mm cameras, and they would... And then they would edit the show and put it together on video, which is why they had to basically go back and re-edit the episodes from scratch.
Wow.
To make them stand up to high def, and so I from reading up on it, it sounds like it's just a lot of work to put it all back. It's like basically you have to go back to the original bits and pieces and redo the shows one by one.
Yeah, I don't.
So how do they work with the... I mean, if the original was only on videotape, how do they improve that? Like, what...
Well, they didn't have to reuse the videotape part because all of the action, the original action parts were shot on film.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Even the models and planets and all that stuff. So, but they
gotcha.
weren't edited together and completed.
Oh,
and they had to...
Okay.
And probably the color wasn't exactly... You know, they were just... It was just raw footage. And all
right.
that post-production that they would have done to you know, finish the show was done on videotape, and so they couldn't use any of that, and they had to go back to the original raw material, so to speak.
So they had to recomposite everything.
Yeah, everything had to be re-scanned in, and you know, there was some incredible amount of film that they had to go back and re-scan, and some of it they couldn't find for a long period of time because it had been misplaced, and it sounds like it was a huge effort to get it all done.
Wow.
So, pretty cool. I obviously, they're never going to do that for a lot of shows, but Star Trek is a big enough business that they can do that.
Yeah.
It's cool.
The old cash cow.
Yeah, and they look great. They really do. I'm sure when they get the them all done, I'll probably fork over the money for the whole set.
Cool.
Yeah. Anyway, back to the episode. What did you think of? Is there a misogyny corner for this one?
I was just thinking about that. Probably the only candidate would be Natira.
Yeah, and she's the only female character.
Yeah.
That I know of.
Yeah. And I mean, they portrayed her as somewhat simple, but she was still a reasonably strong character.
And she does kind of wake up to what's going on eventually, and she's in a position of authority, so
yeah.
I think relatively she's pretty good.
Yeah. Rob?
There's something that stood out to me about her character, and I, you know, she and McCoy have this kind of sort of meeting of equals that happens, and I think is what really kind of makes that romance sort of work, you know?
Yeah.
And unlike Kirk's kind of dalliances with the ladies' planet side, this is much more, you know, genuine.
It's very mature, actually.
I do also think, by the way, it's very mature, yeah. I do also think that there's something interesting about McCoy's choice to leave the Enterprise, which is a huge, you know, in the original series, we don't see the characters struggling with those types of decisions very often. And so it is really, it does make that the episode interesting in that way, that McCoy is really, you know, he's ignoring, he's disobeying orders, and he's saying, you know, I'm going to die, this is what I want to do. So it's really about his life and his choices. But no, I didn't see, of course, Kirk, when Kirk is trying to persuade her, trying to tell her the truth, first of all, it has to be Kirk who does it and not McCoy, right?
Yeah.
And you could probably imagine that it may have something to do with Shatner. But, you know, he whenever he needs to persuade women, he has to manhandle them. Have you noticed that?
I totally have.
Whenever he's really trying to convince women, he like grabs them and like kind of
grabs their shoulders and like
grabs their shoulders. Yeah, yeah. So it's the So that always
you
bothers
got to
me
believe.
When I see it. I mean, I know it's a character choice, and I know he's you got to believe me. But Shatner was another thing, and this is the last thing I'm going to say, because I know it's probably annoying, but Shatner was incredibly powerful force on the set, and from the very beginning, and I can imagine that by season three, he was probably, you know. I'm sure Nimoy did too by this point because it's Spock mania and stuff. But Shatner was like, if Shatner really wanted something, he said, "I think we should do it this way." The directors would probably listen to him. So it was. So some of these things you kind of wonder. You think, "Well, that probably is Shatner." And also, apparently Shatner submitted some story treatments that were actually pretty good. That none of them actually wound up being used. But one of the story treatments that Shatner submitted was the idea. The concept was, and it kind of sounds silly, was this giant space spider. And I kind of wondered if the Tholian web sort of... If somehow the Tholian web was... idea came from that.
Like a nod.
But I thought it was really interesting that Shatner... Not that he submitted, because you could totally imagine him submitting story ideas, right, or story treatments or episode treatments. But the fact that they were actually pretty good is, I think, is surprising, you know. Huh. But anyway,
interesting. What does God want with the starship?
Okay. Oh, don't even. You know, Star Trek V.
No, he didn't write Star Trek V, did he? I don't think he did.
No, he didn't. But Star Trek V is on Netflix, and I don't know.
Yeah, they all are, I think, now.
Yeah, and a couple of weeks ago, I decided, just out of morbid curiosity,
watched it.
I watched about half of it.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I made it halfway through, and I just couldn't go any further. Oh, God. And, you know, the interesting thing is, I was just telling Charlotte this last night, is that I remember reading an article about Star Trek V, and Shatner, of course, directed it, and that was because there was some clause in his contract that everything Nimoy got to do, he got to do as well.
Yep.
So he got to direct a movie as well. And they would be in conferences or the editing room or whatever, and he would have people like Harve Bennett, who was the executive producer of, the movie series, the original classic Trek movie series from 2 through 6. And you know, and he was an experienced both television and movie producer, and there were other people there who knew what they were talking about, and they'd be saying, no, don't do it that way, or, you know, that won't work. And he just ignored them and went ahead and did whatever the hell he wanted to do, and, you know, and they were right, and Star Trek V sucked. You know, it sucked.
Wow.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Okay.
And not really surprising. Okay,
no.
One quick note about the... Did you say this already, John, that the Next Generation remastered episodes are on Hulu Plus?
No, I don't think they are, although I'm not aware. They're on Blu-ray.
It says here the first two seasons are available on Hulu Plus.
Okay, well, that's cool then.
HD.
Well, then you should, if you have a membership there. Yeah, I don't at the moment, but that's good to know.
Hmm.
Yeah, I got my copies through a certain source.
Ah.
That shall not be named. Yes, exactly.
The source that must not be named.
I haven't sampled season one or two yet because, well, I don't have a lot of desire to watch them.
Now, season two was actually pretty good. There are actually several episodes in season two that...
several, yes.
Well... Some at least.
20-something.
Eric, are you a Pulaski man? Is that what you're telling us?
No.
Pulaski man?
Are you a Pulaski man?
No. No, but Measure of a Man is a particularly good episode. That's one where...
Yes, you're right about that. There are a few good ones.
Also, the first episode where Data plays Sherlock Holmes is also a classic.
Elementary
and
Data.
The one where they meet the Borg is good, too.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the concluding episode.
The Q episode.
Right.
That's a good one. Yeah, good. Anything more about this World is Hollow?
Yeah, we keep on going off on tangents.
It's just not that interesting, is it?
I guess it says something about the episode, probably.
Yeah.
Nothing much happened on the ship side, really. There's no energy being in the... Well, I guess they do have that where Kirk has that... unpleasant conversation with Starfleet.
Yeah, yeah. And how about the fact that as soon as Kirk finds out about McCoy's illness, he calls up Starfleet and requests a replacement instantly.
Get him off my ship!
It's pretty much, I want this cripple on my ship.
Right.
It's like, damn, you are hardcore.
Well, especially given that McCoy is supposed to be one of his best friends.
So what happened to Dr. Mbenga?
Mbenga, yeah.
I
don't know, he's...
What about Dr. Mbenga?
Toiling below decks.
Well, if you remember now, I think it was in A Private Little War, Dr. McCoy described him as an intern in the Vulcan ward. So, apparently his internship ended.
Oh, yeah. I guess he went on to something else.
Yep.
Yeah. No, there was a little bit of Starfleet intransigence. I can't really speak when I've had bourbon, but...
Somebody put Bill back in his chair.
So of all the, here's a question for you. Of all the Starfleet Commodores that they have conversations with over subspace,
mm-hmm.
Which do you think is the most memorable in it? Because they all kind of just blend together, don't they? They're all just like these Starfleet bureaucrats. They're all kind of just kind of ornery and sort of.
Yeah, Starfleet Command is basically a, you know, never portrayed in a very positive light.
Oh.
In any of the series, as far as I can tell.
Well, no, not so much. I mean, it depends on what you're talking about with Next Gen. I mean, there are admirals and such that.
It seems like so many of them are either corrupt or they're easily fooled or, you know,
assholes.
Yeah, there's always something wrong with them, and the whole structure just doesn't play very well.
Probably the only
have to have something to rail against.
The one that really stands out for me is Commodore Wesley from The Ultimate Computer.
Yeah, but he's also he's also a starship captain.
Right, but he's still flag rank. He's still.
Yeah, that's true. He represents the brass.
Yeah.
Captain Dunsel, right?
Well, are we good on this one?
I think we're good.
Yep.
I'm gonna vote that we put off Tholian Web until next time, so that we can gather our thoughts and.
Yeah, I think that'd be a good idea.
And all that, plus, I think that would be good. That episode deserves our full attention.
Yeah, there's a lot more there than there is to this episode.
Plus, I went back and watched the two related Enterprise episodes.
Oh yeah, how'd you like those?
They're a mixed bag for me. You know, there are problems with them, but I as a Star Trek fan, they're great.
Oh. I'm gonna have to watch those.
Rob, you really should give it a shot. There are gonna be some things that you'll roll your eyes at, but it's really pretty good. And the way they tie it in with the original series is fun. Definitely. So
yeah.
I think that would be fun to talk about. And if we wanted, we can definitely talk about the series itself a little bit too. But the one thing that give you a preview is that reminded me again is how much I really liked Dr. Phlox.
Dr. Phlox.
Yeah.
He's he is so good in these two Mirror episodes that are in the Mirror Tholian Web series.
Yeah.
He's great. And he was probably the best character in the show.
I don't know that I would agree with that, but I'll watch him again and see.
He could be he may be my favorite.
Yeah. You know,
they always give the fun character stuff to the Doctor.
Yeah.
In Voyager, the Doctor had great stuff too.
Yeah.
So maybe that's just a pattern.
Yeah, with regards to Enterprise, you know, I've seen Scott Bakula and other things where I've liked him, where I thought he's done a good job. But for some reason, the Archer character never seemed like it never really clicked.
No, I don't either. And I had a little bit of time, so I watched a few Enterprise episodes just after that because I was like, you know, I kind of want to look at this again. And I never warmed up to him.
Yeah.
Just I don't know what it is, but and then again, as Eric, I think I mentioned to you over email at some point that him playing the evil Archer character in the Mirror Universe really doesn't work.
Yeah,
because he's just trying he's trying to be scenery chewing moo-hoo ha ha, and he just looks like he's clenching his jaw and spitting out dialogue trying to be quote evil.
Yeah.
That's it. And for him, it doesn't work. Whereas, you know, Phlox just looks like he's having a good time torturing people. It's like, ooh, look at him squirm. Ha ha ha.
Yeah.
He's great. Because he's just a little bit more sadistic than his normal. He played it really, really well. But Bakula just said, I'm going to imitate Shatner being evil. It was this connection that didn't work. And of course, you know, we'll have to go into it next time. But that was one of the problems with those episodes.
Yeah.
But the way they tie it into the Tholian web and the mirror episodes is really clever.
Yeah, it is. And one of the things I like about those two episodes is, well, you know, getting to see parts of the Constitution class starships that, you know, we never saw in the original series. I thought that was really cool.
Yes.
And just seeing the, you know, seeing them in action again was really neat.
Right. You get all this really good special effects stuff with basically a stand-in for the old Enterprise kicking ass.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's Rob. That it's worth it just for that. Even mm-hmm. even if you hate the rest of it, it's worth seeing just for that stuff.
Well, sure. And there's also
and they're in HD on Netflix. Really, really nice.
And they're one of our, I won't say evil, but one of the nemesis races in Classic Trek puts in another appearance.
Yep.
And that was cool.
So, yeah, it's we that's another reason I want to put it off, so we have a chance to talk about that, because I think it deserves a little bit of discussion.
Yeah.
Definitely. Well, good.
Cool.
Well, we'll go ahead and call it a night for that then.
Yeah.
And hopefully not wait too long if nobody's going on a cruise anytime soon.
Yeah, Rob.